Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Sarah Tyson, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Michaela Massimi, professor of philosophy at the University of Edinburgh. Her new book, Perspectival Realism, is just out from Oxford University Press. For many philosophers, the fact that scientists take different perspectives on the world is an obstacle to being a realist about the world. In Perspectival Realism, Massimi argues that, to the contrary, the plurality of perspectives is the driving force behind realism. On her view, the scientific realism that emerges out of the perspectival nature of scientific representation takes perspectival models as inferential blueprints for exploring what is possible. The realist's primitives are not essential properties, but the stable, law-like dependencies that are identified again and again from different perspectives. Massimi also shows how scientific communities develop what she calls natural kinds with a human face, which are evolving groupings of modally robust phenomena that result from the historically and culturally situated systems of scientific practices. Massimi's book constructs a new vision of what realism can be that will be highly influential for years to come. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Michaela Massimi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hello, Carrie. Thank you for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation. This is one of the most interesting books, defenses and explanations and elaborations of realism that I've come across in recent years, which comes from, as the title says, integrating the whole idea of different perspectives in science. So I'm quite sure it's going to be very influential in years coming forward. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of the book itself, maybe you can say a bit about yourself as a philosopher, how you came to philosophy, and then the genesis of this book.
Thank you very much, Carrie, for the really kind introduction. I discovered philosophy when I was in secondary school. I was lucky enough to grow up in a country like Italy where philosophy is taught in secondary school, state schools. And I was mesmerized by the subject at a very young age. But I've always been also interested in science. So I remember as a teenager, I would read popular science books about physics, for example. So when I had to choose at the age of 18 what I wanted to study at university, it was a really tough choice because there was a part of me that was really interested in science. But I think my love for philosophy prevailed in the end. So that's how I ended up studying philosophy at university. The story behind this particular book has been kind of long. It's been a long book in the making, and really started maybe 17 years ago or something. I've always been interested in debates about realism and anti-realism in science, really since I was a postgraduate student. And in a way, my interest in realism has always got entangled with my interest in Kant, philosophy of nature, and Kantianism and philosophy of science in general. And so it was really when Ron Geary's book came out in 2006 called Scientific Perspectivism that in a way I saw in the position that Geary was developing in the book a possible way of answering some of the general questions I had about realism. And in a way, developing the project that Ron Geary started in that book. I mean, Scientific Perspectivism, Ron Geary's book, was not intended to be a book about realism. It was really a book about the role that perspectives play in experimentation and theorizing. But towards the end of the book, he discusses how this might have an impact on our way of thinking about realism. And this is where the book ends. So in a way, I wanted to continue the project that Ron Geary had started, and that's how basically this book took a life of its own. And really, going back to my Kantian interest, there's a broadly Kantian question behind the book, which is how is knowledge of nature possible? And that really shapes the two main questions behind the book. So how do we form a reliable knowledge of nature from a point of view that is always situated and perspectival? And that's a question in part one of the book. And the second question is, how does the world look like as a result of this process, which is the second part of the book?
Right. It's very, very, very well logically kind of oriented into those two parts, the perspectival part and then the realism part. And, you know, and so you give this, you know, perspectival story of how, as you put it, we justifiably infer or form our realist commitments. So maybe we could start with, you know, part one, you know, the perspectival bit. So one of the important moves I think you make in the very beginning is to distinguish two basic senses of perspectival. Could you say a bit about those two different senses and the one that, you know, matters for scientific realism?
Sure. So obviously, the very word perspectival immediately brings to mind the metaphors from the history of art and the role of perspective and perspectival drawing and the impact that the use of perspective had on not only the history of art, but also the history of cartography, the history of architecture, the history of urban planning. So one thing I would say straight at the outset is that, and I really want to dispel a possible misunderstanding that the use of perspective may have in this context, is not meant to suggest in any way the idea of the agent as a spectator of nature. The idea of a perspective has been absolutely pivotal in shaping the way we think about, as I said, cartography, architecture, urban planning. We use perspective and perspectival drawing because otherwise we won't be able to build buildings, bridges, and design entire areas of our urban planning and so forth. So the metaphor of the perspective is key for the things that we do when we build and we construct, and not just for the kind of classical metaphor of the agent as a spectator. And this is something that I developed throughout the book, especially kind of halfway through in chapter 5, where I discuss the analogy with architectural blueprint. But going back to the very basic idea of a perspectival drawing, if you think of a perspectival drawing, really any example that comes to mind, in the book I discuss the Arnolfini portrait by Jan van Eyck as one example of perspectival drawing, and I compare it with Las Meninas from by Diego Velázquez. What is interesting is that the first thing that comes to mind about a perspectival representation is that it is a representation from a specific vantage point. So the perspectivity of the representation is usually understood as the expression of the situated vantage point from which the scene is represented or is painted. But there is another sense of perspectivity that is equally very important. A representation is perspectival because it has one or more vantage points towards which the lines are drawn. And it is the use of those vanishing points that allows the representation to appear as if it was from a specific vantage point. So obviously those two notions of perspectival, what I call perspectival one, from a specific vantage point, and perspectival two, namely directed towards one or more vanishing points, are really two sides of the same coin. So a representation is perspectival one only because it's perspectival two. It's only in virtue of there being a vanishing point towards which the lines are drawn that we can have a representation that looks like it has been drawn from a specific vantage point. But in philosophical discourse, we tend to blur the distinction between these two senses of being perspectival. And so very often what you find is that people talk about the perspectival nature of the representation or the perspectival nature of knowledge without really having in mind the second notion of perspectivity, which is really the one that matters for my realist project, namely that we encounter reality, we open windows on reality via this process of projecting towards a vanishing point. So the whole project of the book is really an attempt to describe how is it possible for human beings like us, wonderfully diverse, through a plurality of historical and culturally situated perspectives, to encounter reality and open up windows on reality in this way. So I'm using the metaphor from the art historian Erwin Panofsky. There's a beautiful essay that describes the history of perspective in art, where he says the importance of perspective and the use of machines like perspectographs in the Renaissance allowed to transform two-dimensional canvas and contingent aggregates of objects into something that looks like a window of reality. So I use this metaphor, opening up windows of reality, as a way of saying that through our scientific practices and modeling techniques, we're able to always from a situated vantage point, opening up windows of reality. And that's the only way through which we encounter the world as being populated with the phenomena that we do believe are real. So that's the part of the book at the beginning where I set out these two notions of perspectival one, perspectival two. And I, really in the bulk of the book, I explore the second notion. So this idea of directionality of the representation, the opening up a window of reality. But I go back to the first notion, which is a sort of more common and the one that immediately comes to mind at the end in the final chapter 11, where I go back to the idea of the situatedness of knowledge and explore more different ways of thinking about what makes scientific knowledge situated.
Right. Good. Good. Yeah. Because one of the, you know, outside of this context, you know, and typically not in discussions, you know, in more, well, in other fields, the whole idea of perspective is wound up with the idea of being subjective as opposed to objective. And so there's a very quick, you know, fallacious argument, but it's very, very popular, where, you know, because we have these perspectives, you know, subjective perspectives, therefore, you know, any sort of theory or any sort of, you know, outcome we have is itself going to be subjective. You don't really get into that issue much, right? But it would be helpful at some point, you know, if you say, you know, how the vantage point sort of, you know, metaphor corresponds or how that's related to this subjectivity aspect of perspective.
Yeah, so that's a very good point, right? Because As soon as one talks about perspective, the first thing that comes to mind is the perspective understood as a subject on system of belief or point of view, kind of colloquially speaking. But that's not the way I use the term perspective and scientific perspective to start with. So that's an important distinction. So there's a big literature about points of view and the point of view of the observer and so forth. But when it comes to science and scientific perspectivism, which is the tradition that I've been following, what we really mean by perspective is the, what I mean by perspective, my own definition building up from Girison's view, which was rooted in the semantic view of theories. So for him, a perspective was a family of models. So he talked about the Newtonian perspective or the Maxwellian perspective and so forth. The way I speak about scientific perspective is as a historical and culturally situated practice of a particular community at a particular time. And by that, what I mean is essentially three main things. So there is the body of claims of knowledge that the community put forward. Then there is the mix of theoretical, experimental, technological resources available to that community to reliably make those claims of knowledge. And thirdly, there are epistemic methodological principles that the community uses to justify the reliability of the claims advanced. So when we talk about scientific perspective in this context, we are really, first of all, talking about communities rather than individual agents. And we are talking about historically and culturally situated systems of practices, broadly understood to include, as I said, theoretical but also experimental resources available to that community to advance those claims of knowledge. The question remains, because people may ask, well, if our knowledge is always situated, is always perspectival in this historical cultural sense, how is it possible for those communities to come to know the world as is? How is it possible to be realist about science? And that has been really the key question behind the book. That's why I started writing this book. That's why I got interested in the whole topic. Because it seemed to me that really we are so accustomed to the idea of scientific realism as a sort of view from nowhere, God's eye view, where we have been trained to think about the best theories in mature science and how they are approximately true, what they tell us a true story about what there is, that we tend to forget that actually scientific knowledge is always situated, always perspectival. We never have that view from nowhere. We have a view that is beautifully situated because there are wonderfully diverse communities that have over time developed tools and technique and instrument to harvest data, to make inferences from the data to the phenomena, to join the dots between the phenomena to the natural kinds. And through that technique, they have opened up windows on reality. It's through that method that we encounter nature as being populated by more than robust phenomena. So effectively, my book is a project in the epistemology of science. It's a way of better understanding how we develop those techniques and tools, those situated practices, so that we can encounter in a robust, reliable, and justifiable way nature as being thus and so. And so there is no subjectivity, because in a way, if you like, the only subjectivity is the subjectivity of historically, culturally situated communities, but the beauty of it is that the reliability of science, so this incredible epistemic feat that we call science, is not in spite of this plurality of perspective, but it's thanks to this plurality of perspective. So what I really wanted to show in the book is that this pluralism of perspective is not an obstacle, it's not a hurdle to the question about realism, but it's actually the driving engine of realism. As soon as one relocates questions of realism from a sort of God's eye view to historically situated communities, I think different kinds of realism becomes available. And obviously spelling out what kind of realism will become available became the project of the book. But yeah, so that's in answer to your question about why there is no risk about the subjectivity as such.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. Which it kind of leads to the sort of the usual perspective, no pun intended, is what you call the problem of inconsistent models. So a lot of, just quite opposite from what you just said. Typically, the idea of a pluralistic view or different perspectives, partial, models that capture parts and is seen as a problem, and you call it the problem of inconsistent models. Could you say maybe a bit about what that more much more usual response is to different models and how your view, differs from that?
Sure. So yeah, the problem of inconsistent model is exactly the expression of this tension that I was describing earlier. Namely, it's usually presented as a challenge to anyone who wants to defend a kind of realism about science. And the starting point is the plurality of scientific models in some areas of inquiry. So the argument would go along the following line. Critics would say, if the purpose of scientific models is to represent specific portions of reality, specific target systems, once you realize that there are areas where there's a plurality of models for the same target system, it becomes quickly clear that we can't really have realism. Or what we can't have is a take on those models as providing us with special access to reality. So the option seems to be either to be an instrumentalist about models, and so take the model pluralism as just instantiation of different tools to make calculations, get things done, but not really representation of the world. Or to take the model pluralism seriously, but at the cost really of giving up on realism altogether. And some of the perspectivalist answers to that kind of objection, I'm thinking of Alex Ruger, for example, have gone along the lines of representational properties. So Alex Ruger has this really interesting argument that he put forward a few years ago, where he said, think of those models as effectively ascribing relational properties to the same target system. So the classical example that people have been developing in the literature goes back to Margaret Morrison, and she discusses different models for the nucleus. So nuclear physics, if we want to study the atomic nucleus, we can use the liquid drop model that describes the atomic nucleus as a drop of incompressible nuclear fluid, or we can use the shell model that describe the nucleus as a series of shells where protons and neutrons sits in magic numbers, or we can use the quark models that describe the nucleus as a bunch of quarks that exchange gluons and so forth. And so the problem with inconsistent model is, but what is really the nucleus? If I want to be a realist about the nucleus, and I get all these different models that tell me something apparently incompatible or inconsistent about what the nucleus is, how can I ever defend realism about the nucleus? So a possible reply is, well, think of those models as ascribing relational properties, really. So rather than intrinsic monadic properties to the nucleus. But critics have been unimpressed. So people like Margaret Morrison, but also Anjan Chakravarthy in his 2017 book on scientific ontology, they have chapters where they describe how perspectivism is either redundant because it's just a restatement of a pluralism in science, or is a kind of bias into some kind of metaphysical inconsistency where the world seems to be some sort of hodgepodge of different things that all seems to be somehow going together and compatible about the same target system. So what I do very early on in the book is trying to dispel some of the premises on which the problem of inconsistent models seems to be based on. And two of those premises have to do with scientific models and the way we think about models and what models are for, really. The first one is that we tend to think of models as representing, as mapping onto reality. I mean, this is a very well entrenched view that models perform their function by mapping onto being isomorphic to specific states of affairs. And the second assumption is that we tend to think of those states of affairs as some kind of ontological truth makers that make claims of knowledge true or false by attributing essential properties to the target system. And what I do in the book is to say, well, it's really only by giving a very, very unduly stringent reading of what models are for that we end up with a problem when we consistent models. The idea of representing as mapping and the idea that there are those truth makers that make our claims of knowledge true or false, and they have to be understood in terms of ascribing essential property to the target system, is not imposed on us. It's not imposed on us unless we buy already into a kind of a strong form of realism that tend to think of reality as having essential properties and tend to think of models as representing by mapping and tend to think of that representation in terms of ascribing essential properties to the target system. As soon as you bracket off all those assumptions, the problem of inconsistent model really kind of dissolves in a way. So the model takes, so the problem takes off the ground only because it really buys into strong scientific realist of a kind of dispositional essentialist flavor at nature. But those assumptions are not imposed upon us. And so as soon as we resist some of those assumptions, then the space open up for developing a different ways of thinking about realism. And so that's kind of the beginning of the journey in a way for the book.
Right, right. So, I mean, yeah, it becomes very clear, you know, you're arguing against that whole kind of essentialist element of at least some forms of realism. So then to kind of follow up on the ontological issue, in the second part of the book, when you sort of focus on the realism, and there are more questions to ask about perspectival models, but since you raised the issue of essentialism, you distinguish, I mean, following, I guess, Bogan and Woodward, you know, data, phenomena, and then how we use our perspectival models or perspectival inferences, which again, you kind of describe, you know, to draw realist conclusions. So that's a lot of things to cover in sort of one question, but let me just sort of summarize that to say, you know, on your view, you know, what are data? What are, you know, phenomena? I mean, you give a very particular view in terms of what you call modally robust phenomena. And then how do we use these, you know, perspectival models to, you know, infer from data to the modally robust phenomena and then draw our realist conclusions?
Sure, thanks. I think, this is an excellent question. And in a way, they take us right to the heart of the book, the second part, where I spell out the different kind of realism that I see as compatible with this plurality of perspectives. So as you rightly said, there's been obviously a long tradition, starting with the empiricists, that have normally regarded phenomena as really no match for realism in science. One can't say that one is a realist about science and defend a kind of ontology centered around phenomena, because traditionally phenomena have been regarded as synonymous with appearances. But there has been a trend away from that kind of view that really started with, as you mentioned, Bogan and Woodward, the distinction between data and phenomena to which I latch, and the more recent work on data by Sabina Leonelli, but also think of Ian Hacking on the idea of how we create phenomena in a lab by intervening and manipulating causal properties of objects and so forth. So there has been an important trend really over the past 20 years or so that have somehow created the space for rethinking phenomena in a different ways. And this is central to my view, because the realism I defend in the book, in the second part of the book, is really centered around the notion of phenomena. And I see phenomena as the end product of a long inferential chain that starts with data and has epistemic communities and their situated scientific practices center stage. One thing I didn't mention before, but is absolutely key to understand my redefinition of phenomena, to which I'll come back in a moment, is a particular way in which I understand this use of a plurality of models. So going back to the example about the atomic nucleus I was describing earlier, my take on that and any other examples where you have a plurality of scientific models in a play is that that plurality of model is really functional to explore what's possible in nature about a particular phenomenon of interest. So the role of perspectival models is very much exploratory in allowing us to deliver model knowledge about what might be the case. And again, I go back to the metaphor about the perspective in architecture. And so I draw this analogy between perspectival models and architectural blueprint as a way of stressing how these models and this model pluralism in particular is absolutely vital to understand how different communities come together to make relevant and appropriate inferences about the particular phenomena that they want to study. So in a way, like in architecture, we use blueprints because the blueprints, historically, before the invention of xerography, allowed different communities of architects, but also masons and carpenters and joiners to exchange information and make relevant and appropriate inferences so that they could build a structurally stable house, for example. Similarly, we use a plurality of models when we want to make relevant and appropriate inferences to deliver knowledge about what's possible about the nucleus, for example. How is it possible that some nuclei in nature are more stable than others? This is a story I reconstruct in one of my three case studies, for example, in the first part of the book. And I give other examples from climate science to the history of developmental psychology. So once you take seriously this idea that model pluralism and a plurality of perspective is absolutely central to deliver knowledge about what's possible, then I think a different view of phenomena becomes available, where the phenomena are not just appearances, they're not faint copies, they're not shadows on the walls, but the phenomena are the seats of the kind of modality that normally scientific realists tend to outsource to essences or dispositions or causal powers and so forth. So the view I defend of phenomena in part two of the book is that there are stable events that can be identified and re-identified, so they're modally robust, by a number of different communities in a way that is entirely inferential and entirely perspectival. So there are different aspects in this definition. So I mentioned phenomena are stable events. So I understand the notion of stability in a way as synonymous with law likeness. So nature comes to us in the form of events that are stable because they are law-like. And the stability of those events is independent of us, is independent of scientific perspective, independent of whatever tools or models or experiments we may run. But for stable events to become phenomena, we need a plurality of epistemic communities that are able to infer them again and again from a plurality of data through perspectival data to phenomena inferences. So just to give you an example, and this is something I discuss in chapter 6 of the book, think of the Higgs boson, right? So when we say that we have discovered the Higgs boson, effectively, what's going on there is that you have a stable event, which is the peak, 125 giga electron volt. Now, that peak is stable, and it's stable because it's law-like. So there are laws of nature. There is a resonance mechanism that underpins the stability of that event in nature. The phenomenon is what we call the decay of the Higgs boson. So what we are detecting is effectively the decay of that thing into a series of channels. So sometimes there's a 2-photon channel, some other times it's a 4 leptons, there are other channels. And you need different communities to be able to make those inferences from the data, the proton-proton collisions of the large hadron colliders, to the stable event in question, the peak 125 gigaelectron volt, so as to conclude that there is a phenomenon, there's a decay of the Higgs boson. So that's an example of a modally robust phenomenon. So historically, when the particle was discovered, and by the way, we are just celebrating the 10th anniversary of the discovery just this month. It's coming up in July. So what happened is that there were these two different teams of scientists, the Large Hadron Collider, some of the CMS, some of the ATLAS. The two machines are different. So the experimental design of the machine is different. They were using the same proton-proton collisions data, but they made inferences to the same stable event, which is the existence of this peak, 125 gigaelectron volt. And so nature comes populated with modally robust phenomena like the decay of the Higgs boson, but also the pollination of flowers or the echolocation in belugas and many other examples in different domains of inquiry. And what you need really is a notion of phenomena as modally robust in the sense that we don't need to outsource that modality that normally does the job for realism to essential properties, dispositions, causal powers, or more broadly, what Gilbert Ryle used to call the hidden goings-on. We don't need the hidden goings-on. There are no two world views, the world of things as they appear and the world of things as they are. All that we have is a world of modally robust phenomena. And I think once we take that stance, really, some of the classical historicist, contingentist, the skeptical objection against realism can easily be deflated or averted because, in a way, we have kind of sheltered, I think, realism from those sort of objections.
I'll raise some skeptical, sort of anti-real. I mean, I could see a hardcore realist sort of saying, okay, you can get all these. You can infer to these modally robust phenomena again and again from different perspectives. They sort of converge on, a certain amount of, what is possible and what is not possible. A hardcore, I think, anti-realist would say, fine, you all converge. As we know from, sort of coherentist theories of truth or, anti-foundationalist in epistemology, everybody can agree and yet everybody could be wrong. I think at that point, I kind of wonder, I think this is one of the questions I had was you do an amazing way of defending realism while taking on board robustly all the valid worries and concerns and complications from perspectives and perspectival models and all that. There seems to be a, I guess just a bedrock part where like either we are justified in inferring, to a realist commitment, or it's like, this is just not enough for me and I'm going to remain, constructive empiricist or, some other form of anti-realist. Do you have some sort of a response to that? Or is that just where, at some point, either all these multiple perspectives, that end up in the same place regarding more modally robust phenomena, is that enough for realism? Is the person who says, no, it's not, is there really any kind of further response to be given to them?
Sure. Yeah, well, that's an excellent question, right? So where does the realist anchor is in all this story about empowered phenomena? So for me, the answer lies in the lawlikeness of the events. So this is the realist anchor, okay? And obviously, there has to be some foundation in any realist project. So mine does away with traditional ideas about essential properties and disposition and causal powers, but take lawlikeness as a primitive notion. So I believe that there are lawlike events in nature. And I believe that that level of realism is enough to deliver the kind of realism that we observe in science. As I said, the peak 125 gigaelectron volt is there. It's not going to go away. The bending of the cathode ray is a phenomenon. But so as I said, for the phenomena of first ontology that I develop in the book, I see these two levels, in a way, applying the notion of phenomena. There's the stability of the events, and there's the modal robustness. Now, modal robustness, I take it to be a secondary quality. So it's really an expression of how different communities come to infer again and again the same stable events from a plurality of data sets. But the lawlikeness of the events, the fact that there are events in nature that have lawlike dependencies, I take it to be a primitive. So there has to be some foundation in any realist story. So most scientific realists would be happy to delegate their role to causal powers or disposition or whatever. But in my view, their role is placed by law-like dependencies. So that there is a 125 gigaelectron volt peak is a stable event in nature. It doesn't depend on scientific perspective. Obviously, we need something as sophisticated as an LHC experiment to be able to detect that peak, that's for sure. But that peak is part of the fabric of nature, in my view. And similarly, that there are electrically charged particles that are bent in the presence of a magnetic or electric field is also a law-like event in nature that, again, we need a machine, like we need cathode rays to be able to see that. But doesn't, you know, it's the stable event in itself is where the realist story is. And then the inferentialist, the perspectival aspect is at the level of the modally robust phenomena. And I see your point. I see your objections. Like, but how do you strike this sort of middle ground here in between, there's a standard scientific realist story that will want more and will want to delegate the realism to causal power disposition and so forth on one end, and the historicist / conventionalist / contingentist that will just happily dispense with all of that, including my notion of phenomena, and just to go fully coherentist about all that. Well, one of the attraction of perspectivism, really, and actually one of the sources behind the view that I've developed comes from epistemology and Ernst Saussure's work on perspectival knowledge. And if you think of that tradition was developed precisely to strike a middle ground in between a traditional foundationalist view and traditional coherentist view. Was a way of saying, is it possible to have actually somewhere in between what you call the pyramid and the rafts, right? The rafts of coherentism and the pyramid of foundationalism. And so this idea that there are, in a way, two levels of knowledge, a level where we have reliable knowledge and a kind of perspectival ascent where we look at the justification for the reliability of the sources of knowledge, originates precisely from the attempt of answering those questions about how to go beyond the traditional, foundationalism and coherentism in epistemology, scientific realism / I would say conventionalism when it comes in the philosophy of science. And obviously the tension is there. So I didn't write this book in the hope to persuade the diehard metaphysician or the diehard, conventionalism to join the perspectival realist camp. I mean, I'm perfectly aware that people that have a more I don't know, more robust metaphysical intuition than I ever had. I'm not going to be moved by some of my arguments. But I guess I took the purpose of the whole book was really constructive. So I was not meant to give any kind of, knockdown arguments against the metaphysicians or the conventionalists. I think I give a series of fairly localized moves as I go along in the book to explain why I don't buy into essential properties or why I don't buy into full-blown contingentism. But really the main purpose of the book was to show that there is a different ways of thinking about realism and try to articulate as clearly as possible where that kind of different form of realism, how that form of realism could be developed. It was a kind of a positive purpose of the book more than kind of proving that the opponents were necessarily wrong in their metaphysical intuition. And most of these claims when it comes to realism and anti-realism, we have all, I think, endorsed the kind of Van Frassen take on stances. I think a lot of it comes down to stances that people have on metaphysics, on epistemology, and so forth. But showing that there is a different way of thinking about realism and how that different ways of formal realism could be explained and teased out was really the main purpose of the book.
Right, and I think you achieved that, in space. So let me just following up on that. For me, and I think probably more generally, you also elaborate within this framework a very interesting, again, sort of perspectival view on natural kinds, which you call natural kinds with a human face. And these are, groupings, evolving groupings of phenomena, morally robust phenomena. So can you explain your view of natural kinds?
Sure, I'll try. It's a book that extends over several chapters, from chapter 7 to chapter 10 of the book. And it is a big chunk of the book because, as I said, if the purpose was to show that it's possible to think of realism in a different way, I had to engage with the debate on natural kinds, because traditionally scientific realism has been a realism about kinds, so those natural divisions in nature that scientific realists tend to associate with a list of necessary and sufficient properties for kind membership. So very often there has been appeal to macrostructural essential properties back to Hilary Putnam. And if we want to know what water is, well, we need to find out the macrostructural essential properties. Water is H2O. If we want to know what gold is, we need to look at atomic numbers. So it's element with atomic number 79. If we want to find out what lemons are, we need to look at the genetic code and identify that and so forth. And I've been resisting all that. I think a big motivation for perspectival realism has been really some kind of mistrust of this talk of macrostructural essential properties or essentialism in general, especially when it comes to natural kinds. So the big question for me, and probably one of the biggest challenges in writing the book, was how to go from this sort of broadly Kantian view about the phenomena as morally robust phenomena, as all that there is, to natural kinds, which are the sort of things that scientists talk about. As I said, we don't talk about the phenomenon of the decay of the Higgs boson. We talk about the Higgs boson, the particle Higgs boson. We want to know what those natural kinds are. And so the view I developed in the second part of the book is that natural kinds, I call natural kinds with a human face. There is a kind of anti-foundational / Neurath boat sort of motivation. It's a view that says natural kinds are historically identified and open-ended groupings of morally robust phenomena, where really the law-like dependency that are the realist underpinning of those morally robust phenomena, as I was explaining earlier, play an important role in helping different epistemic communities over time to kind of join the dots among those different phenomena and allow them to do what I call truth-conducive conditional supporting inferences, which is a bit of a mouthful for saying that we have reliable mechanisms to explain why some phenomena go together and some others don't go together. So the open end, so the grouping is open-ended, is fallible, is fully revisable. And that's what we want our natural kinds to be, precisely to make them impermeable to the classical skeptical objection that, you know, historicists have raised against realism all along. How do you know that we are, you know, how do you know that the electron is real? In the past, we believed in things like caloric or phlogiston or ether, and we now know that they don't exist. How do we know that our best theories in mature science will not end up like caloric theory in 100 years down the line? I mean, all that sorts of argument really has a bite as soon as we think of natural kinds as carving natural disjoint, being identified by macrostructure essential properties. But once all that is removed, and what you have are modally robust phenomena that historically situated communities have reliably and justifiably identified, insofar as we have a way of showing why some of those phenomena form groupings and others don't, we have a way of explaining why we have the natural kinds that we know and love without that level of certainty or necessity that is vulnerable to the classical historicist objection. And so that's what I try to show in those chapters. But also I wanted to defend some intuitions that we have about what natural kinds are really for. For example, you know, again, against the macrostructural essentialists, there was a news in 2019 that a group of scientists had discovered, have engineered Akimoji DNA, DNA that consists of 8 nucleotides rather than 4, and it made the news headlines. And I was thinking, those are important areas where really science is redefining the boundaries of how we think of natural kinds. And we want to make room for those engineered kind that prove to have a very effective naturalness, as much as we want to explain why in the past we used to believe in things like caloric and phlogiston, and why we now regard those as what are called empty kinds, because there is no such thing as caloric and either. And so the story I develop is that every kind is born as an in-the-making kind. And some of those in-the-making kind eventually make it and become evolving, always in an open-ended and fallible, revisable way, and others become empty kinds when at some point scientists discover that some of those phenomena didn't really quite get together. Think of the kind of phenomena that were associated with the ether, right? I mean, it was invoked to explain all sorts of things if you read the queries in Newton's Optics. So it was the medium of electrical phenomena, magnetic phenomena, obviously optics, but it was also invoked for all sorts of physiological phenomena and so forth. So the law likeness is key right here. This is, again, the realist anchor in the story, the ability to identify those law-like dependencies at work in the different phenomena and allows different communities to make those inferences. Are those two phenomena really belonging to something that we can call a natural kinds, or they don't? And if they don't, then sometimes what we thought were natural kinds prove to be empty kinds, like in the case of caloric or ether. And others will go from strength to strength, will become evolving kinds. So that's, in very broad stroke, the story I tell in chapter 7 to 10.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's a huge amount of really interesting stuff there. And I think, you know, I would just encourage listeners to, you know, to actually, you know, go through it and read these chapters to get the finer points. I do want to get to the final chapter where you kind of go where you show sort of where your perspective of realism comes up against what we were talking about earlier about, you know, subjective, objective, those sorts of concerns that are often associated with perspectives. And you talk about, you know, the problem of epistemic injustice as it can appear in this sort of, you know, very, you know, different sort of context than it, that it usually comes up in. So could you just, could you explain a bit about, you know, first of all, I mean, it's clear that different, you know, historical, cultural, epistemic communities will, you know, contribute. But then the injustice appears in the ways, and you identify two specific forms of injustice where certain perspectives get left out in a certain way. Can you explain that connection between perspectival realism and epistemic injustice?
Sure, thank you. Yeah, I'll do my best. I mean, again, this is the final chapter. It's called Multiculturalism and Cosmopolitanism in Science. And although it's a final chapter, it actually has some of the really main motivations for the book. As I outlined at the beginning of the book, I wanted to write a book about the different ways of thinking about realism for a number of reasons, not just because I had different metaphysical intuition from the standard scientific realist, but actually because I was really interested in questions about multiculturalism in science that seems to have completely escaped the debate about realism and anti-realism. So traditionally, we tend to think about those debates as kind of happening in some sort of idealized, frictionless plane. We never really think about scientific knowledge production as historically, culturally situated, as, you know, the knowledge that pertains to a specific community, a specific time. And so one of the main motivations for writing the book is to do justice to that situatedness of our scientific knowledge. So going back to the metaphor of perspective that we started with, going back to the first notion of perspective, knowledge that is always from a specific historical cultural vantage point. This is a theme that I develop in the final chapter. And now one of the aspects that I stress about the situatedness and the perspectival nature of our knowledge is that it is really knowledge produced by a plurality of epistemic communities that have, as I say, methodologically intersected and historically interlaced. This is a bit of a jargon that I explain in the book, but I see the dynamics of the different scientific perspective as intersecting and interlacing, absolutely central to explain how we produce reliable scientific knowledge over time. So first of all, I wanted to stress the fact that scientific perspective extends well beyond specific geographical, sociopolitical boundaries, and also that scientific perspective should not be understood as some kind of scientific membership or, you know, scientific homeland in a way, because if we understand it in that way, then we really risk unjustly cutting out big portions of the society or, you know, important epistemic communities that have historically contributed to scientific knowledge production. So just to give an example, which is again linked to the discussion about natural kinds with a human face and the example about the electron in chapter 10, I think it would be a mistake to think of the what we tend to call the Faraday-Maxwell scientific perspective as the exclusive repository of a particular community that was working in a particular historical, cultural, institutional environment at the time, without taking into account the plurality of other epistemic communities that at the same time were making possible the scientific knowledge production. So the classic example that I give in chapter 10 is that we associate obviously the discovery of the electron with J.J. Thomson experiment at the Cavendish Lab in 1897 and his ability to identify the charge to mass ratio, what it, at the time he called the corpuscle. But we tend to forget that that tradition of experimenting with cathode rays was really made possible by the flourishing of a glass blowing industry that developed in the second half of the 19th century. We know, for example, that J.J. Thomson had his own personally trained glass blower, Ebenezer Everett, at the Cavendish Lab. So you need that kind of know-how, that kind of often practical and artisanal knowledge that allowed those discoveries to take place. And even before that, you need the communities of Scottish crofters in the Hebrides that were able to burn ashes of seaweed and produce the alkali flux necessary for the production of glasses. So going back to the issue about epistemic injustice, what I stressed in the final part of the book is that once we take seriously that situatedness of the human knowledge, we need to be careful in not cutting off portions of that seamless interlacing of scientific perspectives that has been pivotal for the ability to advance reliable scientific knowledge. And so part of the motivation of the book was precisely to defend the human point of view as a way of reinstating communities that we tend to forget about when we write narratives about science. And kind of expand your horizon and look at how those different communities have fruitfully engaged with one another and interlaced with one another to make that knowledge of nature possible. And so whenever we have other an intentional severing of the narrative that excludes those community, or worse, what we have is sometimes a ring fencing of scientific knowledge as if it was the exclusive repository of one community against others, then epistemic injustices arise, what I call epistemic severing and epistemic trademarking. And then I kind of hint towards the end to an alternative way of thinking about all this that doesn't buy into the risk of severing of epistemic injustices. So a picture about cosmopolitan science as a picture of science where it's really a human right that belongs to everyone in virtue of being a citizen of the world. So this is the very, very last section of the book, and something that I want to work more in the future.
Good. Well, that does actually bring us to the end of our time. So I like to end with a question about what you are working on in right now as a follow-up to the book, or what sorts of projects are you turning to at this point?
Yeah, well, precisely what I was mentioning just a moment ago. So I finished the book and I thought, gosh, I need to write another one, which I don't know whether or when I'll have the time to write next. But in a kind of unexpected way, I ended up getting very interested in debates at the intersection of legal, political theories on science as a human right. So there's an important debate in that area that normally philosophers of science don't really go into, but it's a debate well known to political theorists and, as I said, legal philosophers and so forth. And it's a debate that really starts with the UN Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 that looks at scientific progress as a right, as a human right. And again, it continues in 1966 with the International Covenant for Economic, Social and Cultural Rights that reinstates the right to enjoy the benefits of scientific progress. So this idea of scientific cosmopolitanism as a science to the benefits of a world citizen is something that became very salient while I was writing the book, also because we were in the middle of a 2-year pandemic, and the debate about vaccine nationalism obviously became very timely and pressing to everyone's eyes. The fact that science is produced in a way that still not only there are epistemic injustices but big structural socioeconomic injustices in accessing the benefits of scientific knowledge. And so this is an area where I hope to write more. So I've written a paper now for a special volume on scientific progress edited by Yafeng Shan. It's coming out in December. I just wrote a short comment in Nature Physics that has been published earlier this month. That kind of gives the broad lines of the area. So yeah, good more work for the future.
Excellent. Well, that all sounds very exciting. I'm sure a lot of people will be very interested in looking for that work in the future. But so we are out of time now. So I do want to thank you again for speaking with us at New Books in Philosophy. It's been a great conversation, and I wish you best of luck with the new work that you're doing as an outgrowth.
Thank you so much, Carrie, for having me, and thank you really very much for this really excellent and stimulating question. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Michaela Massimi, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Edinburgh. We've been talking about her new book, Perspectival Realism, which is just out from Oxford University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.